You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, BC. This radio is diverse, independent, and always yours. Check us out at cjsf.ca or search CJSF 90.1 FM on SoundCloud.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Most of us have discovered that life is never a straight line. It actually resembles a series of zigzags. We zig in order to strengthen our creative gifts. We zag in order to provide a roof over our head and food on the table. Today we'll be looking at the life adventures of a father, a husband, writer, a corporate marketer, a world traveler, a meditation and yoga teacher with our guest, Karan Bajaj. His most recent novel has elements that reflect his own life as he juggles a corporate career, art, and family. Bajaj has incorporated sabbaticals from corporate life in order to travel and deepen his spiritual journey. He continues to wrestle with some of life's great questions, such as what makes a meaningful life. Karan Bajaj was born and raised in India and has trained as a Hatha yoga teacher at the Shivananda Ashram in South India. He learned meditation in the Himalayas and has been named one of India Today's top 35 under 35. He lives in New York City, but soon to be returning to India with his wife and young daughter. He's the author of several novels, including Johnny Gone Down and Keep Off the Grass, both of which were number one bestsellers in India. His most recent novel is The Yoga of Max's Discontent, also known in India as The Seeker. Join us for the next hour as we explore how one person attempts to live the yogic life in the heart of the material world with our guest, Karan Bajaj. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Karan, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. You have your feet in two worlds, it seems. And so how do you reconcile those two worlds?
In the beginning, I would think it would be the same conflict that people talk about, art and business and stuff. But I think over the last few years, it's evolved to a little bit of what I think of as a one-stream view, in which I just see life as a continuous journey of growth and transformation in every field. And sometimes it ebbs and flows more towards my writing. Sometimes it ebbs and flows more towards my career. So I've stopped kind of wrestling with that question too much. For example, to give you a particular example, I've just finished my novel, which is just, you know, The Yoga of Max's Discontent. It's out right now. I'm publicizing and promoting it. I'm now starting a new job as I'm going to lead a media network in India as the CEO, and I'm going to work on that undistracted for the next couple of years. And then again, I'm sure I learn a lot from the job, would want to express it through writing again, and then I'm going to probably take a detour again and write. So I'm trying not to wrestle with it too much. I'm just trying to flow and ebb and flow according to what's needed, and just like trying to learn and grow with every activity that I do.
So it sounds like you're practicing being present with what is right now.
Exactly, with what is right now, and just going, this concept in India, which we call dharma, is an interesting concept, which is about that every being has a natural tendency. For example, the tendency of a tree is to grow and bear fruit. It's not to flow and become a river. So in a sense, what I'm trying to do is to purify, I guess, my life, my thoughts, my actions, so that I'm just a conduit for my best tendency, if you will. And sometimes it is like I have a very good business mind, and that's fine. And I have a reasonably good creative side, and that's fine as well. And I know it's some combination of business and creativity. And I just try to express it the best through that, rather than have this very kind of convoluted debate with myself. Am I a business guy? Am I an artist? Am I combination? Like, I'm some combination of that, and I express myself in my best way. In whatever the situation arises, when it arises.
So in other words, you're not compartmentalizing your life. It's kind of all connected in some ways.
Exactly, yeah.
I want to talk about, you have taken several sabbaticals from corporate life.
Yeah.
And I would love for you to share with us, let's say, one of your earlier sabbaticals, you took a year off, and can you describe how you managed to do that and your travels?
Yes, absolutely. So over the last decade, I've kind of defaulted, I guess, into something which I call like a 4-1-4 rule, in which I work for 4 years and take a year off, then work for 4 years and take a year off. And like, I've done it 3 times now. And the first sabbatical I took was in 2007. 4 or 5 years after I started working, and I was with Procter & Gamble, and I left to, essentially, the first one was very basic. I just left to backpack and travel, and I lived in places that I'd always dreamt about and fantasized about for no particular reason, but I just felt like that I wanted to really live in Mongolia, and I wanted to live in Bhutan, and so I just did that. Like, so there's no great, like, you know, rhyme or reason behind it, but I just did that. But the interesting thing that happened in the sabbatical was that for the first few months, I just traveled and backpacked, and I realized that I was actually not very happy while doing it, which was very contradictory to the way I thought it would be, because it was my life stream to travel. But I realized that I'm a very achievement-oriented kind of person, and going and seeing a cathedral in Germany and then seeing another cathedral in Mongolia and then seeing the desert, and like it was just observing and seeing, and I just was very honest with myself, saying that this is not enjoyable for me. And then suddenly I started to write. So that kind of started to anchor those days of like listlessness, if you will, of just traveling without a purpose. I started to anchor it with writing, and I'd never written creatively before. So this was the first time I attempted to write, because it just felt like the right thing to do at that time. And that anchored my days a lot during the sabbatical. And at the end of that year, I'd written a novel, despite having never written anything, like even a short story before. I had written a novel that went on to do very well in India. And that kind of sparked this whole idea that if you can completely deconstruct your life, you don't even know what you're capable of, right? So the reason I started writing was because suddenly there was this vacuum of not working, of not having certain habits, patterns, life, like being away from my environment. And that led to me figuring out that I could be a writer. And I actually wrote a novel which did quite well. So I was suddenly like, I should really systemize this principle of breaking down my life completely every couple of years. So then I came back, worked again for a few years, and then broke my life down again the next time over and did something similar. And so I'm kind of now practicing this principle that I should never get too comfortable with my environment. I should like willfully break myself down every couple of years. Yeah.
Oh, that's a great challenge. And because we do get so immersed in our habits and routines, and so breaking out of them. And also talking about writing, it seems to me, and I think that you've said this in some of your blogs or I've read it somewhere, that, and I know it's true for me, sometimes I don't know what I know until I write it down, until I'm doing some sort of creative writing or journaling, or for me, it's writing. I write essays, and then I find out, oh, I didn't even know I knew that. Is that somewhat like you?
Very much, absolutely. And I think now I'm writing more and more, especially all the blogs and the videos and stuff that I do. They do pretty well. Like, I have a pretty good audience and like all that stuff. But I've honestly, I'm doing it very much for myself in a way that I'm trying to synthesize my idea down on a particular topic to its very core essence. And writing helps me do that. Otherwise, it's a bunch of disjointed thoughts. I think writing gives me the discipline of synthesizing all of that into one coherent stream. And that's very, very liberating.
Going back to your travels, I want to talk about how you got into yoga. And I think you really discovered that in South India. Am I correct in that?
I did a yoga teacher's training in South India, but I did a lot of meditation up in the Himalayas where I grew up in the mountains.
So you grew up in the mountains?
I grew up in the Indian mountains, but in Shimla, which is actually a little bit different from the place where I did my like meditation training and all that stuff. But I grew up in the Himalayas in Shimla in India. Yeah.
Well, that a pretty special place. Can you describe what that was like?
Yeah,
for
it was special. It's become a little bit more touristed now because India as a country has grown. But when we were growing up, it was very kind of idyllic in some ways, almost what you could think of as a small Indian mountain town, if you will. Very kind of disconnected from the world. I would like to call it was very spiritual, but I would say that our relationship with spirituality was a little bit conflicted in India when we were growing up, because people of my generation wanted to like leave our tradition behind. So we kind of associated yoga, meditation, all the people who came to do yoga and meditation with a little bit of the either loserish crowd, or we would think of them as being people who things to do after retirement. And we never thought of it as, so we were almost kind of, we wanted to be Americans really. So I think in that, like, our aspiration was to kind of break out of that circuit completely. The funny part is that all of those memories remained with me. So when I was growing up in Shimla, near us, there were many ashrams, and you would always have both Indians and Westerners, and very qualified Indians, like doctors, lawyers, engineers, who would leave everything behind and stay and live in ashrams for years. And at that time, we were very puzzled, like, why would anybody leave success and do this, right? And we didn't aspire to that at all. But the funny part is that I left India, like, followed my trajectory of, like, you know, being in the world, like, experiencing a lot of things. But then I had the same pull, and I did exactly that, you know, 35 years later.
In a slightly different way, though. You would do it like in these sabbaticals, so to speak, and then rather than leaving, let's say, corporate life or work all together, you rather than waiting till you were older, you've been doing it interspersed.
I would say, though, that my sabbaticals in the beginning were very external. Very outer directed. So they were traveling, like, you know, backpacking through like South America, etc. But the last sabbatical has been very inner directed. So that's very different from my previous sabbaticals, because I've spent the last sabbatical really in ashrams, first in the South India in the yoga ashram for two couple of months, then in the Himalayas for 4 months. So I was very silent in this period. That was a little unusual. So I think I've always been in touch with the yoga meditation thing, but never deepened my practice until a couple of years ago through this. Yeah.
I'm here with Karan Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. And if you want to know more about his work, you can go to his website, karanbajaj.com. And he spells his name KaranBajaj. .com, or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Karan Bajaj, and he is the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. And there was something that you mentioned earlier, something about doership. And this is in connection with the meaning of life and how we, you were talking about how we, one of the meanings would be to lose our sense of self and really just be instead of do. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. Again, there's a beautiful thought which I really like, which says that a yogi's actions are neither black nor white, they are colorless. So a yogi is not trying to do good or bad in the world. He's just trying to be a spontaneous, he's just spontaneously acting. So that's a beautiful thought, which really means that the yogi's world, like yogi's job is really to simplify, to purify his life, really. Like, which means to have us, the whole practices are meant to still his mind and purify his thoughts and purify his actions. And that's all he's supposed to do. It's beautiful because I think too much times in the West, people are like trying to help this world, help the world. And like, you know, and they're like different expressions of ego, even in that.
Being an activist,
if you will, while a yogi is not trying to be black, white, he's colorless, he's just spontaneously. So what I, that's in a sense what I'm trying to do is to be silent enough so that if my best expression is to do good in business, for example, if I'm joining a media company and I'm doing like spontaneously, I'm doing good work in that media company, that's my expression rather than trying to do good by going to high tea and like doing something that's not in line with my purest natural tendency. So in a sense, that's what the beauty of this is, that if you can really silence your mind, you'll end up expressing yourself in the way which is most organic to you and will end up doing the best possible action that is your destiny to do in this world.
So it, being a, let's say a householder, I know that you're a father, you have a young daughter, you're married, so and you're working in corporate settings, and then you're a writer, you're a novelist, and so all of that has a lot of expression in it. You're expressing a lot, but you're holding it in a way of not being attached to it,
Something like that. Yeah, no, I think that's very well said, not being attached to it. So like if I, for example, today, which I see with many writers is if I tend to get attached to this idea that I've come up with a novel, it's doing pretty well, Random House wants me to write my next novel, and I have my audience, and what should I do? And like these are all decisions based on attachments of what, like, you know, the ideal path of a writer should be. My approach is more like my feeling right now, based on a pretty silent life, my feeling right now is that my best expression right now is in doing a CEO role in India in a media company. And that's completely fine. I don't really have any attachment at all to what happens to the audience that I've built up and the publisher wants my next novel within 18 months. I mean, I have none of that. Like, maybe I won't write for 3 years until I feel like that would be the next best expression. So like that would be the time to express myself. So I feel very, contented with how I can express myself, and I have no like goals and attachments towards. So I think that's pretty purified action, because then it allows me to be present without conflict. And yeah.
What about the idea of, it's a Buddhist idea of being a bodhisattva, coming back to be helpful to others in some way, that one person maybe has reached a state of enlightenment, so to speak, and yet they make the decision to reincarnate or to keep coming back until all beings have reached that state of oneness. What about that concept?
Again, very hard to like rationalize or not, but that's, I think that's the Hinayana thing versus the Mahayana thing, or, it's a belief. So like, it's not kind of completely conversant with my beliefs, but that's nothing to say whether that's right or wrong. But I genuinely don't believe that, like that, that I guess my destiny is to come and enlighten millions of people. I feel like everybody has a certain dharma, a certain push, a certain tendency, and you're best served. You're best serving the world by acting in line with that and not going outside that. So if the bodhisattvas, if that concept exists, then basically what we're talking about is people whose destiny it is to help millions of people. And that's beautiful. I mean, like, you know, that that's very similar to what I would also say, that if there are some people whose natural dharma, natural thrust is to help millions of people.
That when you talk about belief, that goes back to, like, I don't know if I would say that you may not have a belief in belief.
I mean,
you really, in the book, The Yoga of Masks is Discontent, you kind of go through some things where even I can't remember exactly, but what, not to be attached to even the slightest sort of belief, belief in suffering or non-suffering, or belief in being anesthetic, or belief in even yoga or whatever. It's just like to release it all is what you've kind of come up with.
Yes, exactly. I think my end conclusion is to silence my own mind, which like the chitta vritti nirodha idea, if you will, which is that I'm best served by silencing my mind and then acting very spontaneously based on what the natural thrust within is, rather than like attaching myself to I'm going to help this world or I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Those are all kind of attachments that, at least in my perspective, pull you down into acting out of accordance with your natural thrust.
There is a Zen saying, to chop wood, carry water. And in that saying, it's kind of, and I think that you come to this towards the end of the book, it's like that you still act in the world, but I guess the Zen saying would say, before enlightenment, you chop wood, carry water. And then after enlightenment, you chop wood, carry water.
Yeah.
So what's the difference? And that's kind of what you're trying to get at, I think.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that in that there is really, the before enlightenment, you are acting in line with what you should be acting at, and after enlightenment, you're just acting in line with what you should basically be doing exactly the same. In an ideal state, you should be doing exactly the same activity because you've been given a certain natural thrust. So having said that, the best example is the Buddha himself. If you think of it over generations, there have been many enlightened people. Like there have been many, obviously, enlightened men up in the Himalayas. There are people who are like practicing this full time. Very few have had the thrust after enlightenment to come and awaken millions. Most of them have had the thrust to just be in the caves and let the body go after
and
a period of time.
We never hear
of them because that's what they said about the Buddha, that his past lives were his karma and his dharma was a monarch. Like he was a king who had an impact on a huge kingdom. And then in this life, he became a saint who got enlightened and his thrust, his natural tendency was to impact millions of people. And he did that in his enlightened state. And most people's tendency would be to either be on their own or to help five people. And that's why you have all these gurus helping five or six disciples. And that's their kind of activity after enlightenment. So I don't know. I don't think I'm going to get enlightened in this life. But my feeling is that if I do get enlightened, I'll go back to my job and work. That's what's going to happen.
From the outside, it won't look any different.
Exactly, it won't, because it'll just be like I'm acting in line with my thrust now, and after awakening, I'm going to act in line with my thrust. I'm not going to become the Buddha who's helping millions of people, because that's not my natural state right now, or at least in this lifetime, that's not my state. Yeah,
right. I know that you have a blog about how to change your life. And it was very interesting to me. Some of the, you list about six things. And it was very interesting to me. One of the first things that you list about changing your life is to create, to follow our creative impulse, mm-hmm. that this is part of the joy, I would think, of being alive is that,
yeah.
I think you have some statistic that, let's say, for art, most of us, 98% of us are consumers of art and not creators of art. And so what would you say about the creative process?
Oh, it's, I think, the most beautiful thing that happened to my life is, and I'm really, I guess if there is one regret, you can't even call it a regret because that's the way it was meant to be, but I have a little bit of a regret that for the first 27 years of my life, I never created. And then at age 28 is when I started writing my first novel, and I think my life is completely transformed after that. So I wish I had believed in creating before, because in every form, what started was that my first novel was a very basic effort, but it took all the water that was in the well. So for the next novel, unconsciously, I knew I had to fill the well again. So I sought out so many new experiences to fill the well again. Then I drew on it for the second novel, the well emptied again. Then I sought. So what happened was that if I'd never drawn the well, I would never have had the impulse to or the thrust to keep filling the well again and again. So I think that's the beauty of the creative process, is that it pulls everything that you have and then forces you to keep replenishing it and keep replenishing it. And that just keeps expanding your life and makes your life bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's beautiful. I wish I'd started it earlier, you know?
Yeah. Well, you've started it early enough. You're still under 40. So you've got a lot of years. But one of the things that we in the West, for sure, and possibly now many people in India as well, we're filling our lives with busyness. So I know you have something to say about busyness and being busy. And what's your advice?
My advice is to shun busyness. And I think I know, even now, if I think of a day in which I, even simple act like writing a blog or doing a YouTube video, the contentment that I have at the evening is very different from the days when I'm doing technically busy work, like replying to emails, getting my calendar sorted, figuring out this, doing that. I can just sense the level of satisfaction and silence that I have at the end of the day is completely different in those two cases. Right. So I think we know when we are filling our life with mundanity, and when we start creating, we know that sense of silence, the sense of being, feeling that this is complete, this is what I'm completely acting in line with my my presence as a human. So I think you note that, and it's beautiful if you start noting that and automatically start shunning those busyness to get into more of creation mode.
Creation mode. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Karan Bajesh, and he's the author of The Yoga of Max's Discontent. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions.